The topic of this morning's lecture is the creation narrative revisited, the current controversy through Rashi's eyes. Imagine that you have just been accepted into a prestigious graduate program, say in advanced mathematics. And you come to class on the very first day and the professor takes out the textbook that he expects everyone to obtain for the term. And you look down and you see that it is a first grade math textbook, teaching you how to add and subtract. Or imagine you are in an advanced PhD program in American literature. And on the first day, the professor told you you had to read I Would Like to Be a Fireman. You know, one of those books that are shaped like a fireman's hat that you read in nursery school? You'd be pretty taken aback. And yet, when it comes to the study of Torah, the very same text is studied by a first grader just starting to learn Chumash after his or her Chumash party. That same text is studied by the greatest Talmidei Chachamim and Gedolei Hador when they learn Chumash. And the question is, how is that possible? How is it possible that the same exact text can be relevant both for the first grader who's just new to learning without any life experience and to the most advanced and accomplished Torah scholars? In this morning's shiur, I would like to explore with you a very familiar story, one that you have learned numerous times, the story of Maaseh Bereishit, the story of creation. But to spend sort of some time together figuring out what's different when we approach it now, at perhaps a slightly later stage in our lives. But before we start that, I should mention that there is the idea, and this is the first source in your sheet, that perhaps actually we shouldn't be talking about this at all. If you look at the Mishnah in Masechet Chagiga, Parak Bet Mishnah Aleph, it says, "Ein dorshin ba'arayot b'shlosha, v'lo b'maaseh b'reishit b'shnayim, v'lo b'merkava b'yachid, ela imkein hu chacham u'mevin midato, kol ha'mesakel," etc., etc. It says, the story of Maaseh Bereishit should not be studied, should not really be taught or explained before even two people. What does this Mishnah mean? This Mishnah is cautioning those who seek to delve into and understand the secrets contained in the story of creation. Because of the mysterious and often very cryptic formulations in this parak, the rabbis were afraid that it could lead the unprepared mind into a state of confusion, perhaps even a potentially religiously debilitating confusion. And it is not for the human mind to question that which is beyond its comprehension. Indeed, on some level, these rabbis argue, it's none of our business. If you look in your next source, the Pasukim in Mishlei, Perek Chaf Hei. Kivod Elohim haster davar, uchvod melachim chakor davar. Shamayim larum, v'aretz laomek, v'lev melachim ein cheker. It's the glory of God to conceal a matter, and the glory of a king to plumb a matter. Like the heavens in their height, like the earth in its depth, is the mind of kings unfathomable. God's mind, states the Pasuk, is impenetrable. We will not understand him or his ways. And the Rashi on this Pasuk in the Gemara Shabbat, Kufnun Gimel Amud Bet, again the next source on your sheet, says, Kivod Elohim haster davar, mutar lahasir divrei Torah l'chavod shamayim. It is permissible to conceal, to actually hide words of Torah. Why? For the glory of God. So again, there is a major school of thought within Orthodox Judaism which maintains that when it comes to the story of creation, it is not for man to ask questions, to attempt to ascertain a comprehensive perspective on the overarching goals or the details of the narrative account. But rather, accept it as truth, again, whatever that means. Don't pry its contents for theological assertions, answers, or explanations. Because the leaders of this community think that actually, potentially, it could lead to more damage than good. Once you start delving into the story of creation, there are too many difficulties, too many philosophical questions, too many things that, again, could push someone potentially, quote-unquote, off the derech. And so these leaders assert, for the glory of God, for a nobler goal, avoid plumbing the subject in any kind of depth. And that is a major school of thought within Orthodox Judaism. So again, in many communities, the understanding of Perek Aleph of Bereishit never really goes beyond a kind of superficial interpretation. You read the text with the Mefarshim, understand their basic points, and move on. In our community, however, we do grapple with this text on a very deep level. Many Talmidei Chachamim grapple with this text. Thinkers and scholars, some of whom have actually spoken here at YU, rabbis such as Nathan Slifkin, who's written extensively on this topic and was actually castigated by that community that we mentioned earlier, as well as Professor Nathan Aviezer, I know, was here just a couple of weeks ago, among others. They write and speak about the lessons of the creation story and how we can make sense of this exceedingly complex text. On some level, we hold that once the classical Mefarshim have spoken about it, it's our duty to unpack it as well. And after all, we're taught the story from the time we're little children. We all came home with nursery school projects with six boxes on it, and every day, it had, you know, what was made on that day of creation. And then for many, again, that was the first thing you learned in first or second grade when you started learning Chumash. I always remember, I mean, you learned it in a tune, and you spent, you know, a week on the very first pasuk, you know, that... You learned it in a sing-song in those days. It was, right? Bereishit, Barishona, in the beginning. And everyone remembers those first couple of psukim because you spent all this time, right, learning Maaseh Bereishit as a first grader. But then, you know, those will argue, well, we're not really learning it. We're learning how to translate the words, and we're just getting through the basics. But I would say that when it comes to the story of creation, to Bereishit Aleph, there's no such thing as basics. Every single pasuk begs for interpretation. And in our community, we consider it acceptable to at least ask certain questions and attempt some kind of meaningful interpretation of this story. So today, there is a major debate amongst Jewish scholars, Orthodox scientists, Rosh Yeshiva, about what exactly to make of Bereishit Aleph. There are, of course, numerous ways to read the Perek. But the bulk of the arguments can actually be divided into two major camps, which I will summarize briefly here. There are those who argue that Bereishit Aleph is a recording of how God created the world. It is a historical account that can, in fact, be reconciled with modern scientific theory. And it must be. Right? The assumption is that Bereishit Aleph is God's recording of how he created the world. But science also has an account of how the world came into being. So using advances in the fields of physics, cosmology, and paleontology, these religious scientists try to prove that Bereishit Aleph is indeed a plausible account of creation. They employ the theory of relativity, of particle physics, etc. I'm not a scientist, so I really don't understand how all of this works. But they argue that you can actually reconcile 21st century science with the account of the 6 days of creation recorded in Bereishit Perek Aleph. And several books have been written on this topic. So methodologically, when these thinkers approach Bereishit Aleph, what questions do they ask? How was the world created? What was the order of the creation? And again, they try to find similarities between modern scientific theory and Bereishit Perek Aleph. That's one camp. On the other hand, there are those who argue Bereishit Perek Aleph is a foundational religious text, and it need not, and actually should not, be reconciled with modern science. These scholars argue that the Torah is not a science book. Right, it's not a history textbook, and therefore, Bereishit Aleph is not a historical or scientific account of creation. The questions we should be asking is not what happens on each day, how does that fit with modern scientific theory, but rather, what point is the Torah trying to make? What is the theological significance of the stories? We need to understand, they argue, the Torah in its own context as a religious work. The Torah is a book of wisdom, not of historical or scientific fact. So methodologically, when these scholars approach the text, right, they consider the historical context in which the Torah was given. What was the impact of Bereishit Aleph on Bnei Israel when they first heard the Torah? What are its assumptions about God's relationship to the universe, to mankind? And what educational lessons does it seek to impart? right? These are very different methodological approaches to the study of Bereshit Perek Aleph. And the debate between these two camps of scholarship is intense. Again, those who are arguing Bereshit Aleph is a historical scientific account and must therefore be reconciled with modern science. And those who say, no, it's not, it has nothing to do with science. It's a religious work, and therefore we should be looking for the theological and religious implications of the text. I don't really want to weigh in on this debate at the moment, but once I was presented with this machloket, it radically changed the way I read Rashi on this perek. And it struck me that although how to understand Bereshit Aleph is a big issue, it's not necessarily a new issue. Because one can actually see traces of the notion that perhaps there are multiple layers of truth and methods of interpretation in this text, as is reflected on Rashi's own commentary on the Chumash. Rashi himself, as we shall see, finds multiple ways to interpret the meaning and the significance of this parak. Again, Rashi is often viewed as a simple commentator, but he actually has tremendous depth, and his scholarship is at times overlooked. Right? The uniqueness of Torah is that, in fact, it has so many layers of meaning, enabling it to be learned and analyzed again and again and again and on different levels by people of vastly different experience and understanding. So in the remainder of this morning's lecture, I'd like to take a look at a very familiar story with an eye towards contemporary scholarly Orthodox thinkers, as well as Rashi's tremendous insight into unpacking the deep truths which he uncovers in this text. Just a very brief introduction to Rashi, though he is a commentator that really needs no introduction. His full name is Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. He was born in Provence in 1040. He died in 1105. And he's acclaimed really for his ability to present the basic meaning of the text, a difficult term we'll get to in a moment, in a concise yet cogent fashion. And he appeals again both to learned scholars and to beginning students. Our greatest commentators actually recognize that. Ibn Ezra, playing on a name found in Megillat Esther, refers to Rashi as the Parshan Data, the interpreter of our religious text. And Ramban, borrowing a phrase from a later in the Torah, says of Rashi, Lo Mishpat HaBechora, he has the right of the firstborn, meaning his is the first interpretation that must be considered, and that's why Ramban himself often engages with Rashi at the beginning of his commentaries. And actually, if you look, there are over 300 super commentaries which analyze Rashi's choice of language and citation. So we have over 300 people who devote their studies just to figuring out what Rashi was saying. And the necessity, I think, for so many commentaries on Rashi is largely due to the fact that Rashi was so concise. And unlike some of the other Mefarshim, he never really explicitly outlines what his methodological approach is. There are numerous, very few times in the Torah where he gives us a little bit of a hint into what he's doing. So what I'd like to look now is source number 4. This is the Rashi in Bereshit Gimel Pasuk Chet. This is the story of Adam and Chava in Gan Eden. Right after they had eaten from the tree, it says they were hiding, and it says they heard God walking, they heard the Kol Hashem walking in the garden at the windy time of day. Okay, so this is the Rashi, source number 4. יש מדרשי אגדה רבים וכבר סדרום רבותינו על מכונם בבראשית רבה ובשאר מדרשות. There are many midrashic explanations, and our teachers have already collected them in their appropriate places in Bereshit Rabbah and other midrashim. So he says, this was the rabbinic way. There's a collection of midrashim, and they're compiled together in books like Bereshit Rabbah. But he says, ואני לא באתי אלא לפשוטו של מקרא. I, however, says Rashi, am only concerned with the pshuto shel mikra, the plain sense of scripture, with such agadot, with those midrashim, that explain the words of scripture in a manner that fits in with them. So Rashi says, He is trying to distinguish himself from the earlier rabbinic exegetical methodology known as Midrash. Rashi says that he came along to do what? To give us the Pshuto Shel Mikra. But before we get into what exactly that phrase means, I should point out that Rashi actually never defines what he means when he says, I'm here to give you the Pshuto Shel Mikra, and what exactly is Drash, and what is the significant difference between them. The only way we can determine by what Rashi meant by Pshat and Drash is by reading Rashi, and when he says I'm quoting a Pshat, or when he says he's quoting a Drash, and see if we can sort of tease apart some kind of distinction. But just methodologically, this is an important point to understand about Midrash. The approach, the methodological approach of Drash is that every word of Torah needs to be interpreted not only in its own context, in the pasuk or parsha or parak in which it is found, but also has independent elements with a life and meaning of their own. Right? Every detail imparts a lesson because you can extrapolate any word really and give it a life beyond just its immediate context in a particular pasuk, in a particular parak. So Rashi says that when he does quote Midrashim, or Divrei Agadah, Agadah HaMiyashevet, right, it's only those Midrashim which help explain the plain sense of the text. Okay, but that's the problem. What do we mean by plain sense of the text? What exactly is Pshat? It's a word that I think we throw around a lot, right, that especially is popular today. Oh, what, I don't want to know what the Mefarshim say. What's the Pshat? Right, what does the Pasuk say? But Pshat is an extremely difficult term to define. When we say the plain sense of a text, the plain sense is radically altered depending upon what you think the sense of the text actually is. Depending on what you think the goals of a particular text are, will alter what the plain sense of the words in that text are. So, for example, right, if I'm reading the following line, her eyes were the moon. And I think the context, the plain sense of what I am reading, is a young man's physical description of a woman he just met. Of a young woman he just met. Her eyes are the moon. So I'd have to figure out what that means. Does that mean the whites of her eyes were very big, or the eye color was a grayish white? Right, I'm trying to figure out what he means by the moon. He's physically describing a young woman. Her eyes are the moon. What does that exactly mean? But if I understand her eyes or the moon is in the context of a poem, then the plain sense of that phrase is radically altered. Right? Perhaps what he's saying is, her eyes lit up the darkness of his own night. Or so, right? And that would be the plain sense. Her eyes were bright. Whatever that means, the plain sense is altered because now I'm reading the text not as a physical description, but as perhaps an emotional reaction to the young woman that he just met. So again, the pshat is difficult to determine unless you have pre-established what the sense and goal of the text actually is. That's what makes reading Rashi so difficult. Okay, but one could say with some level of certainty that Rashi's definition of pshat is just a literal, immediate meaning of the words based on context and syntactic structure. But we still have to determine what Rashi thinks the goal of Bereishit Perek Aleph actually is. And it becomes more complicated when Rashi, in his own commentary on one pasuk, or one phrase within a pasuk, quotes both a pshat and a drash, right, in one answer. We don't know exactly why, again, because Rashi never describes his methodology. When Rashi feels the need to bring both a pshat and a drash, we don't exactly know why, and we don't know exactly what the relationship between the pshat and the drash that he brings are. It does seem clear, however, that Rashi thinks that both the Midrash and the Pshat were intended by the text. So again, Rashi's goal, he says, is to find the literal meaning of the text. He only uses Midrashim when they help explain the literal meaning of the text. But again, what the literal meaning of the text is depends on what you think the goal of the text is. Now, does Rashi ever state what he thinks the goal of including this story of Maaseh Bereishit in Chumash actually is? Because if methodologically we know that he is trying to explain the pshat, we should have no problem determining his understanding of the purpose. We should be able to go through the Rashis on the Perek and figure out what he thinks the goals are. But we'll see in just a moment that once we get to the second Rashi in Chumash, we run into a bit of difficulty. But we're lucky, because in the very, very first, very famous Rashi on Chumash, Rashi actually does think what he say straight out what he thinks the purpose of Torah is, what the purpose of including Maaseh Bereishit in the Chumash is. So if we look together now in Source 6, this is the very first Rashi on Torah, and his question is, why are we starting? Why does the Torah start with the story of creation? Okay, let's look at it together. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak says, Lo hayat tzarich lahatzcha haTorah ela mehachodesh hazeh lachem. Where should the Torah really have started? With the very first mitzvah in Shemot, haChodesh hazeh lachem. This is for you, Rosh Chodesh. That is the first mitzvah. Now you'll argue to me, what? There are certain mitzvot already in Bereishit, like Purur Revu and Brit Milah and Gidon Asher. But haChodesh hazeh lachem was the very first mitzvah given to Bnei Yisrael as an Am, as a complete nation. So this is really a first mitzvah, as Rashi continues. Shehi mitzvah rishonah, and it's tavu by Yisrael. This is the first commandment that Bnei Yisrael was commanded. The matam patach beBereishit. But what's the reason that it starts with the story of creation, with Bereishit? Mishum, and here Rashi quotes a pasuk from Tehillim. Koach ma'asav higid la'amo latet lahem nachlat goyim. The strength of his deed he told to his people in order to give to them the inheritance of the nations. How does Rashi understand Koach Ma'asav is referring to what? What are the strength of his deeds? That is in fact referring to Bereishit, to actually creation. God told his people, meaning Bnei Yisrael, the story of Koach Ma'asav, the story of creation. Why? To give to them the inheritance of the nations. What does that mean? She'im yomru umot ha'olam liYisrael, that if the nations of the world come to Israel and say to them, listim atem, you are thieves, shekivashtem artzot chivagayim, because you conquered the land of the seven nations. Right, you're thieves, you stole the land of Israel. Haim omrim lahem, Bnei Yisrael can respond, kol ha'aretz ha'kadosh baruch hu hi, the whole land belongs to God. Hu bara'a b'natna la'asher yashar ba'enav, he created it and can give it to whoever he deems worthy. Birtzono nitna lahem, through his will he gave to them, uvirtzono nitala mehem b'natna lanu. And through his will he took it from them, from the Sheva Amamim, and gave it to us. Now this is a very problematic Rashi for many reasons. Okay, but let's just make sure we understand the basics. What is the reason that Rashi says we need to start the Torah with the story of creation? So when the nations of the world accuse us of stealing the land of Israel, we will have what to respond to them. We will say the first parak of Bereishit, God created the world. God can give the land to whoever he wanted. It's his earth. And whenever I read this Rashi, I think, wouldn't that be so nice? We'd be sitting down at the Mideast Peace Talk, and all we'd have to do is say, we'd love to compromise, but, you know, this book, maybe you've never read it, Bereishit Perek Aleph, says the whole world belongs to God, and he gave it to us, so there's really nothing to talk about. Sorry. Right? It doesn't work. Right? We tried to use this argument, God gave it to us, some people buy it, and many people don't. More people don't. So the question is, what's the purpose of this Rashi? And I think really it's to give the Jews, it's this idea of an internal polemic. It's the idea of giving ourselves chizuk. No, God gave us this land, right? It gave the Jews in times of Tzarot an internal kind of chizuk. Look at Bereishit Perek Aleph. This whole world belonged to God, and he chose the land of Israel, and he gave it to the Jews. And that's, I think, what the purpose of this Rashi is. But this Rashi is very telling about what Rashi's approach to what the goal of the Torah is. According to this Rashi, what is the overarching purpose of Torah? What is the overarching purpose of telling us Bereishit? It is about the relationship between Bnei Yisrael and God. The reason we need to know the whole story of creation is kind of, okay, it has to set up this major axiom in the Torah, which is that God created the world. But the essence of Torah really starts where? In Shemot, right? The essence of Torah, the purpose of Torah is really the mitzvot. The essence is about the brit, the covenant that God made with B'nai Yisrael. That's the essence of Torah. Yeah, we needed this for some other reason. We needed the creation story for some other reason. But the essence of Torah, the essence of these five books of Moses, really doesn't start until the middle of Shemot when we actually get the first mitzvah. The problem is, since the Torah elaborates somewhat beyond just this fundamental axiom, there must be some other lessons for us to learn in the more detailed description. Because if not, the Torah could have just said, "Bereishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz." God created the world. Okay, and then move on. Why do we need all the details of the creation story? Right? This Rashi, okay, good, it tells us that we definitely need to know that God created the whole world so that we have what to respond to the Goyim when they accuse us of being robbers. But that doesn't tell me why I needed to know that light was created on day one and why the sky was created on day two. Right? What are the significance of those details? So Rashi doesn't say in this Rashi, but if we look at the rest of the Perek, that's exactly what he does. So what I'd like to do now is to consider three Rashis, in which he brings both a pshat and a drash explanation to explain the meaning of the text. And I have specifically chosen Rashis from before the creation of man, because I think everyone will agree that once man is created, theological messages about the relationship of God and man abound. But how do we make sense of the details of creation pre-man? Of all the different creations that we're told about on particular days, why is that necessary? What can be learned from knowing all of these details? How does Rashi make sense of creation before man even entered the world? So let's begin now by reading the very first pasuk. In source 5, I gave you the whole text of Perek Aleph. So just look now, everyone knows the first pasuk. I'm not going to sing it in the sing-song tune, so don't worry. Bereishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. That pasuk is usually translated as, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." But this term, Bereishit, is an unusual term. This is actually the only time it occurs in Torah. It occurs in Nach, which we'll get to in a moment, but it's the only time it occurs in Torah. And so if you look down, Rashi has the question of what does this beginning of the Torah mean? So he begins, and this is in the source sheet, source number 7. Ein ha-mikra hazeh omer ela darsheni. He begins by saying, this verse calls aloud for explanation in the manner of drash. Kimo shadarshuhu rabotenu zal b'shvil. Just like our rabbis have interpreted, Bishvil HaTorah, Shenikret Reshit Darko, Ubishvil Yisrael, Shenikru'u Reshit Tvuato. How does Rashi understand this term, Breshit Bara? Breshit, the bet here, is saying, Bih, for the sake of Reshit. And what was called Reshit? Bishvil HaTorah Shenikret Reshit Darko. He quotes a pasuk from Mishlei and says, when it says in Mishlei, Reshit Darko, the beginning of his, referring to God's way. What's the beginning of God's way? It's metaphorically referring to what? The Torah. And he quotes another pasuk, Bishvil Yisrael, and for the sake of Yisrael, the nation of Israel, Shenikru'u Reshit Tvuato, the beginning of his harvest. Metaphorically, B'nai Yisrael are called the beginning almost of God's harvest. So now, going back to the pasuk, how does Rashi, according to the Midrash, read this pasuk? Bih, for the sake of Rashi, for the sake of Torah, for the sake of Israel, bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. God created the heaven and the earth. Again, what Rashi does, what the Midrashim do, is they take the word Rashi from other places in Tanakh where it is metaphorically referring to Torah and Am Yisrael and apply it here. Now this works very well because this Midrash is stating the purpose of God's creating the whole universe was for what? For Torah, for the sake of Torah, for the sake of B'nai Yisrael. Now that fits very nicely with what? The very first Rashi on Torah where he says, what's the whole goal of Torah? The mitzvot, it's about the covenant between God and B'nai Yisrael. And here he's saying, in fact, the whole reason the world was created was for Torah and B'nai Yisrael. What does that mean? Now, what's the theological significance of that kind of a statement, that the whole world is created for Torah, that the whole world is created for Bnei Yisrael? Because if you look at the first 11 prakim of Bereishit, it has nothing to do with Torah. It has nothing to do with Bnei Yisrael. It's about the creation of the universe. It's about universal humanity, right? And what does Rashi do with these prakim? He's basically saying they're just a prelude. They're just kind of an introduction to the real goal. And what's the real goal? Getting to Am Yisrael. Getting to Torah. So what is he doing here? He is making the ultimate ideal universe constructed from the very first pasuk. The ideal universe is one in which what? In which Torah and Bnei Yisrael reign supreme. Here what Rashi is doing is something very significant. He is saying that he's placing value on Torah even more, even beyond the brit made between God and Bnei Israel in Shemot. It's not about the development of history and this people came about. No. For the very fabric, the very purpose of God creating a universe was for Torah, was for Bnei Israel, and without it there would be no purpose. And this, I think, sheds light on a very interesting Rashi found in Shemot Yotet. It's not on your sheep, but you're familiar with it. It's a famous midrash. Rashi quotes an interesting girsa of the midrash of Har Kegigi. It says Bnei Israel, when they were about to receive the Torah, stood betachtit ha'har, at the bottom of the mountain. Right? Betachtit is an unusual word. So Rashi there quotes a pshat and a drash, and he says, what's the pshat? They stood at the foot of the mountain. But then he quotes a very famous midrash that God took the mountain and lifted it above their heads. And as most of us know the story, God said, if you accept the Torah, good, and if not, this will be your grave. But the Girsa Rashi actually quotes in his Perush on Chumash there in Yotet, is God saying, God picks up the mountain and says, if you accept the Torah, good. But if not, the world will turn back to tohu vavohu, to void and nothingness. Why? Because this wasn't just about Bnei Yisrael's own acceptance of the Torah, and if they didn't accept it, okay, the world would continue. Not for them, maybe, but the rest of the world would continue. No, because to Rashi, if Bnei Yisrael hadn't accepted the Torah and Shemot Yotet, the whole world would have had to go back to nothingness, because it didn't have anything to stand on. The whole reason God created the world was for Torah, was for Bnei Yisrael. That's the Midrash. Now Rashi gets into the Pshat. Look back inside. Ve'im bata lefarsho kipshuto. If you want to explain it according to its, again, plain sense, kach pershehu. This is how you have to interpret it. Breishit briat shamayim va'aretz. Va'aretz hayta tov v'vohu v'choshech etc. v'yomar Elokim yihi or. Here's the key point. What word in Breishit bara did he change? He makes the word bara, which is a past tense verb, in the beginning he created, to what? To present tense. Right? In the beginning of his creating. Look, continue on. The law Bahamikra Laho wrote Seder Habriya Lomar She'elu Kadmu. The point of the text here is not to say what came first. Why? Well, here's my problem. If I translate the very first pasuk in the Torah as Bereishit bara Elokim et ha'shamayim ve'et ha'aretz, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, what do I assume was created, was the very first creation? Heaven, right? Followed by earth. Right, in the beginning, God created the heaven and then the earth. What's the problem with that interpretation? On what day do we know Shemayim was created? Day number two. And what day was Aretz created? Day number three. We now, if you are reading this according to the Pshat, we are left with a kind of historical or perhaps scientific conundrum. How is it possible that God created the heaven and the earth, but they weren't created until days two and three? So Rashi has to make sense of this pasuk in terms of the historical accuracy of the parak. And so what does he say? It's not coming to teach you the order, saying which one came first. Why? Back inside. She'im ba lehorot kach, because if it meant to teach this, hayalo luchtov barishona bara et hashamayim. Okay, if it came really to teach you what was created first and what was created second, what word should have been used in place of Bereishit? Barishona. At first, God created the heavens and the earth. She'ein lecha reshit b'mikra she'einu davuk l'teva shel acharav. He says a very interesting, he makes an interesting grammatical note here. He said the term reshit in the whole of Tanakh never occurs outside of its construct form. Meaning, it's never in the beginning or the beginning, period. It's the beginning of. It must be followed by the word of, and he gives examples. Here we have, again, the term Breshit, from Breshit Mamlechet Yehoyakim. How do we translate that? In the beginning of Yehoyakim's reign. Not in the beginning Yehoyakim reigned, but in the beginning of Yehoyakim's reign. Reshit Mamlechto, at the beginning of his reign. He quotes another pasuk from Dvarim, Reshit Gancha, the beginning of your, the first fruit of your grain. Afkan ata omer, Breshit bara Elokim, kimo, Breshit bro. In the beginning of God's created. So how does Rashi understand this very first pasuk? Not as telling us what was created when, but we can understand it more as a what? An introduction to the parak. In the beginning of God's creating the heaven and the earth, and we go to the next pasuk, ba'aretz hayta tova bohu, the land was void and nothingness. Nothing's actually being created in pasuk Aleph. It's letting us know, what are we about to read? A story of God creating the heavens and the earth. Okay, now this is a really perfect example of why a translation that you will read in English is always going to be an interpretation. Right? Because sometimes you're going to read a Chumash where you see it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And that's in fact how Ramban translates it. He has a whole different perush. But Rashi, if someone's translating according to Rashi, how will they translate the very first pasuk? In the beginning of God's creating the heaven and the earth. And there's a significant difference about, is something created in pasuk Aleph? Or is nothing created in pasuk Aleph? And that's a significant difference. Again, translations are always interpretations. Okay? So that's the pshat. Again, for the midrash, this is not a problem. The historical conundrum figuring out what was created on, in the first pasuk, because it contradicts with days 2 and 3, not a problem. Not the question the midrash asks. Why not? Because according to the Midrash, how should a book of religious significance, a foundational religious work, begin? Not with telling us an introduction to what's about to happen, but with what? A theological statement, which is what? The Midrash, God created the world for the sake of Torah. You are about to read a book that is about the relationship between God and Bnei Israel, and that is the significant message of the entirety of the work, and that's of course what the opening line should be about. It doesn't have to do just with this parak, it has to do with the whole Torah. Okay? So that's our first Rashi, and right away we see what? Two very different presentations of what the goals of Perek Aleph are. Is the goal of Perek Aleph to teach us the story of how God created the world? Is the story of Perek Aleph to convey to us certain theological truths? Okay, we're now going to take a look at the second Rashi. This Rashi is going to deal with the inanimate world, actually the very first creation. Let's look now at Psukim Gimel and Dalet, if you want to flip back. Psukim Gimel and Dalet. Pasuk Gimel. Vayomer Elokim Yihi Or, Vayihi Or. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Next pasuk dalet, vayara Elokim et haor ki tov. God saw the light that it was good. Vayavdel Elokim bein haor uvein hachoshech. And God separated between the light and between the darkness. So I'm reading this pasuk, and what's my immediate question? Well, right off the bat, how is it possible that there is light created without a source? Where is the source of this light? Because we know that when are the luminaries, when are the sun, moon, and stars created? Not until day 4. And yet here there seems to appear this light without a source, not coming from any cosmological body, just existing. This light is out there. So that's our first question. But if you look at the Dibur HaMatchil of Rashi, and this is helpful to do, you often get insight into how much more is actually bothering Rashi. Look at the Dibur HaMatchil. So it says, Vayar Elokim et Ha'or Ki Tov Vayavdel. That's Rashi's whole Dibur HaMatchil. God saw the light that it was good, and he separated. Now, very interesting, he includes the Vayavdel with the phrase, and God saw the light that it was good. And he separated. Right? There is a comma in the etnachta in the pasuk happens after the word kitov. Right? Vayal elokim et ha'or kitov. God saw the light that it was good. End of one clause. Vayavdel elokim min ha'or ubein ha'choshech. And God separated between the light and the darkness. That's the second clause. And yet Rashi takes the first word of the second clause and he attaches it to the first clause in his Dibur HaMatchil. So from that we learn two added things must be bothering Rashi, which you need to know a little bit more about the other formulations of Vayar Elokim Ki Tov and the rest of the Perek, which is, whenever it says Vayar Elokim Ki Tov throughout the remainder of the Perek, and again, this is one of those phrases that repeats numerous times, it appears 7 times that God saw that it was good, okay, it occurs 7 times, other than this time, it always says, Vayar Elokim Ki Tov, God saw that it was good. It never specifies what specifically God saw was good. But what does it say here? Vayar Elokim Et Ha'or Ki Tov. It specifies that God saw the light that it was good. And not only that, but in the other times the phrase Vayar Elokim Ki Tov is used, it's always at the conclusion of a sentence. Right, God does all of his creating, and God sees that it was good. And that's kind of the last line. Whereas here, it's followed with what? Vayavdel Elokim bein ha'or ubein ha'choshech. Something happens afterwards. So Rashi can draw 2 major conclusions from this. One, something about the light in particular was good, and that the light being good was connected to the fact that it needed to be separated from the darkness. So now let's look inside at this Rashi. This is source 8 in your sheet. Vayar Elokim et ha'or ki tov vayavdel. Af bazeh anu tzrichim ledivrei Haggadah. How does Rashi begin? Here too we need to refer to the words of the Haggadah. The very first creation, and Rashi saying, right, again we know that Rashi wants to say the Pshuto Shel Mikra, but in order to get at what the Pshuto Shel Mikra is, he feels compelled to do what right away? Quote a Midrash. Okay, so he quotes a Midrash and he says, the Divrei Haggadah, Ra'ahu, God saw, She'eino kedai lehishtamesh bo risha'im, vehivdilo latadikim la'atid lavo. What did God do? He saw that the wicked, the Rishaim, were unworthy of using this light. So he therefore set it apart for the righteous for the world to come. What is this Midrash giving us? What kind of insight to the text? Okay, so how does this Midrash answer our questions? So what is this light? Good. It's some kind of spiritual, metaphysical light. We're not talking about light that needs to come from a source, like the light we have around us, either from the sun or from light bulbs, right? It doesn't need to have a source. Why? Because it's not the typical light. And I gave you, we're not going to have time now to go into all of them, but a number of sources where the word light is used in another context other than a physical, actual light. The first source, by the way, should be Bamidbar Vav Chaf Hei. I'll just give you one. Look at the second source, Yishayahu Tet Aleph. Ha'am ha'ochim b'choshech ra'u or gadol. The people that walked in darkness have seen a brilliant light. Okay, that's not referring to all of a sudden they were actually walking, B'nai Yisrael, this is Yishayahu criticizing the people, B'nai Yisrael were walking in physical darkness and all of a sudden, whoa, it was light outside. No, it's talking about some level of insight that they had walked without knowing, without some spiritual light or metaphysical light, and then all of a sudden what happened? Whoa, it's like when you use the expression, I have seen the light. Right? What does that mean? It's not actually you saw some kind of physical light that you were blind to before. It means, no, I've received some kind of insight, something that has opened my mind so greatly so that now I understand things I never could have had before. And again, if you look at some of the other sources, the last source, Or Zarua Latzadik, light is sown for the righteous, Uyishreilev Simcha, joy for the upright. Right? That light, this level of whatever or means on this metaphysical level, is something that is set aside for the righteous. Okay, so again, the word light doesn't here mean, according to Rashi, because we have other examples in Tanakh, it's not referring to a physical light. What was the very first creation that God put in this world? Some kind of spiritual understanding, some kind of metaphysical light. So what is that? How is that significant for us? Because what does Rashi say? There is a major theological concept, I think, which Rashi is relating that it is easy to overlook, but he argues is at the foundation of the creation of the world. And what is that? It's the notion of sachar ve'onesh. It's the notion of reward and punishment. Why? Because who is this light set aside for? Who is this ultimate understanding set aside for? The tzaddikim. And who are the tzaddikim? Those who act in a certain way in this lifetime. The tzaddikim are those who behave in a very specific and particular good way, who make good decisions, whose actions are good. And you know what they get because of these decisions, because of their actions? They get this or. That's the reward for them waiting in the world to come. There is a notion of sachar ve'onesh, but very importantly, as we will see, does it always happen in this life? No. Rashi states quite clearly that where will the tzaddikim have this reward? In the world to come. That's where the sachar ve'onesh will theologically play itself out. And I think this is crucial because Bereshit Aleph is a chapter, is a parak of verbs. It's about God's action. Every pasuk is loaded with action. And what is Rashi saying? Yes, because actions are important. This midrash is arguing that it is about what you do in this world. That's the midrash, and there is a reward for the righteous. Now what about the pshat? Let's go back into Rashi. V'lefi pshuto kach parshuhu. If you want to understand the pshat, this is how you have to understand it. Ra'ahu ki tov. He saw the light. God saw the light was good. Ve'eina elo v'lachoshech sheyehu mishtamshin bi'irbuvia. He saw that it was good, but it wasn't good that the light and the darkness were interacting in some kind of confused manner. That light and irbuvia is like a confusion, a mishmash, right? They were somehow existing at the same time in some kind of mishmash. V'kava lezeh tchumo bayom v'lezeh tchumo balayla. So what God did was he limited the sphere of one to the daytime and the sphere of the other to the nighttime. What's Rashi saying? Darkness isn't created in this pasuk. Right? In the first day, darkness already exists in the second pasuk. Right? V'choshech al pnei tahom. Darkness isn't created in the first day of creation. Only light is. Okay? And what do we know? Darkness as we know it is what? The absence of light. And yet, here we know that even after light was created, there was still darkness. So Rashi says these two elements must have, at the very beginning, somehow existed at the same time. Somehow light and darkness must have existed together. What's the problem? You really didn't have either. Right? Because they're existing, bi'irbuvia is what the word Rashi uses. So what God saw the light was good, so in order for it to be useful, God had to distinguish it from dark. God had to separate them and give each their own sphere of activity. Now this is also helpful because the pasuk ends, vayir vayivoker, right? It was, what do you mean evening and morning? How do we determine what is evening and morning based on what body? The sun, there is no sun, right? But if light and darkness could somehow function in the same or a similar being to the way the light and darkness of the sun functions, then we can still have spheres of activity that could be parallel, quote unquote, to what we call day and night. Okay, so what's Rashi doing here? In the pshat, Rashi is trying to figure out what the very first day of creation actually looked like. What is this light? What is this darkness? If I'm telling over the story of creation as a historical account, what did creation look like on the very first day? So there was dark, which is just the absence of light. All of a sudden, light comes onto the scene, but it's existing in some kind of mishmash with the darkness. So what does God do? He relegates each to its own sphere. That's the goal of the pshat. But what had the midrash done? It's trying to find, to seek some sort of guide for human beings in God's other creations. Very different approaches to the same pasuk. Okay? And from here we'll move on to our final Rashi. This Rashi occurs a number of days later. This Rashi occurs in the realm of the animal kingdom, when God has already begun creating creatures. So, let's look now at Pasuk. This is on the fifth day. Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Pasuk Chaf Aleph in the text. Okay? Vayivra Elokim et ha-taninim ha-gdolim. God created what usually gets translated as the great sea monsters or the great sea creatures, that kol nefesh hachaya haromeset asher shartzu hamayim, and all the creatures that creeps and came out of the water, sprouted out of the water, lumineum, each according to its own kind, that kol of kanaf lumineu, and each winged being according to its kind, vayar lokim kitov, and God saw that it was good. So what's being created on day five, as we know, the fish of the sea creatures, and the birds. Okay? Now, when we come across this phrase, Vayivra Elokim et hataninim hagdolim, we have a number of problems. First of all, and the most basic are, what are these taninim hagdolim? We've never heard of them before. Well, that's a problem you could really ask on any word in Breishit Aleph. We haven't heard of anything before. But what are these great sea creatures? This question is made all the more complicated by the following. One, the term vayivra, and God created, the verb, beis resh aleph, has not been used since when? The very first day. So we've gone through days 2, 3, 4, and finally, for some reason, for the creation of the taninim hagdolim, we're going back to that first word, bara, created. The only other time the verb bara is used in Breishit Aleph is by man. Okay, by man. So we have the very big creation of the world, okay, by Yivra, by man. And again, Ramban, by the way, points out, this isn't Rashi, Ramban points out that whenever it says the word Vayivra, it's referring to what? What's the significance of the verb bara? Yesh me'ayin. It's only creation, ex nihilo, something from nothing. Okay, we're not going to get into that now, but we have all of a sudden the term Vayivra created by the taninim we haven't had since the very beginning of creation. That's number one. Two, they are called ha taninim hagdolim, the sea creatures. What's with the? Should I know who they are? The? Oh, the. Okay. Right, I mean, am I supposed to know who they are? That, hey, seems to indicate that they have some importance, that we should know them. Also, they are called hagdolim. Very rarely do we have adjectives describing any of the creations. We have them, or hagadol and the or hakatan, the two luminaries, the big one and the small one. But that's actually their names in the parak, in order to distinguish between, they're not called sun and moon, for polemical reasons, right? But they're called the big light and the little light. Okay, but that's describing them. These are the taninim that are big. I mean, we don't have that by anything. We don't hear about any other creatures that are large. So why hagdolim? Also, we almost never hear about a subcategory of species. All of a sudden we're hearing about sea creatures. Okay, say they created the fish. Why are we hearing about a particular type of creature? We don't hear, and God created the animals. And the lions, and the bears, and the... No, it's just the animals. Why a subcategory? And also, if you look at the word taninim, the question is, you'll notice, is this a plural word or a singular word? What's the problem? If it was plural, what should it end with? Yud mem. But you'll notice there is no yud. Okay? So taninim, is taninim referring to, and God created one creature called the taninim? Or is it the taninim, right? A number of taninims. That's the question that we have when we come across this. Okay, let's look now at Rashi. This is source number 9 on your sheet. Rashi begins, Hataninim, dagim gidolim shabayam. How does Rashi define taninim? They're really big sea creatures. They're really big fish. Maybe this is referring to whales. We don't know. That's the pshat. Why? Because Rashi's trying to tell you, okay, here, listen, he doesn't answer all of our questions that we just had, but he said, what are the taninim? They're these large fish. Okay. Now let's look at the second part of Rashi. Uvidivrei agadahu. And again, what does he do? He's quoting a midrash. Livyatan uven zugo shebaram zachar unikeva. What is the taninim? It is the Livyatan, the famous Leviathan, the great sea dragon or sea creature of the deep, who we'll explain in just a moment. Livyatan uven zugo, the Leviathan and its mate, shebaram zachar unikeva. They were created male and female. V'harag et hanikeva. But God killed the female. Umacha latzadikim latid lavo. What did God do? He kills her and salts her for the tzadikim, for the world to come. She'im yifru v'yirbu lo yitkayim ha'olam bifneihem. Because if they were allowed to multiply, the world couldn't stand before them. The world would completely collapse. So now our first question is, what exactly is this Leviathan? And I know we don't have time now to go into all these sources, but here are all the different places where the term Leviathan occurs in Tanakh. I'll just read you, let's just look at the first one. This is from Yeshayahu. Bayomahu yifkor Hashem b'char bo ha'kasha v'ha'gdola v'ha'chazaka al Leviathan nachash bariach v'al Leviathan nachash akaton v'harag et tanin asher bayam. The reason I picked this is because what two terms are used in the same pasuk together? The Leviathan and the tanin. Right, which we said, this is an explanation of the tanin. In that day the Lord will punish with his great, cruel, mighty sword, Leviathan, the elusive serpent. Leviathan, the twisting serpent, he will slay the dragon of the sea. Okay? And if you look again at the other sources, it constantly refers to the Leviathan as this extremely powerful and evil character. And again, it's unclear what animal, what kind of animal this is exactly. A whale, a crocodile, a dragon, some kind of sea monster. Okay, many of the descriptions of the Tanin is very similar, of the Leviathan is very similar to those of the Taninim, very, very similar. And many Midrashim deal with the Leviathan. And it seems, based on the various descriptions, I think, of this creature, that perhaps it is not referring to a physical creature at all, but to an idea. The Leviathan represents a concept. And I think you can see that in the Midrash, which Rashi conveyed. What is that concept? In many of these psukim, the Leviathan is represented as the enemy of God. What's the enemy of God? Evil. The Leviathan represents in many places in Tanakh evil. Right? That's why Yeshayahu says, what will happen by Yomahu on the day of Hashem? Right? He will punish the Leviathan. He will eliminate the Leviathan. Again, the next pasuk in Tehillim, it just says, it was you who crushed the heads of the Leviathan. Right? That's God asserting his power. Because what does the Leviathan represent? Evil. So what is the major theological message which this midrash is trying to convey? And I think answers all of our questions. Number one, Vayivra. This is a major, major concept. God created evil. Okay? Evil is not beyond God's control. He created it. Vayivra. But what? Originally it was created with what ability? To reproduce. The Zachar and the Keva. Evil was given the ability to reproduce at its own will. But what did God do? He limited evil. What did he do? He slaughtered the female, the one with the reproductive ability. He didn't eliminate evil altogether, but he did not allow it to reproduce and multiply and wreak havoc beyond control. Because then, says the Midrash, the world couldn't stand. So God, again, would not allow evil to take over, to multiply recklessly. And here's the final part. So there is evil out there. And sometimes that evil is very powerful. And right, this brings up the philosophical question of theodicy. Right? How do we reconcile God and religion with the problem of suffering and evil? This is an age-old question. Most famously in the Tanakh, the whole book of Eov is dedicated to this question. And it's a question that really has no answer. But what is this Midrash telling us? Yes. In this world, sometimes the Leviathan, the Taninim, the evil, has power. It can have some measure of control. And sometimes the righteous are affected by this. We have this notion of tzaddik v'ra lo. The Leviathan can affect even the most righteous. But where will there eventually be justice, says Rashi? Latid lavo. In the world to come. Because what will happen in the world to come? The good will consume, the tzaddikim will actually consume the evil. so that the evil no longer exists. The righteous will overpower, will consume that evil. And I think that is the message of this midrash, that God created evil, that's the Vayivra, and that we need to know that that evil is out there, the Hatanim and Hagdolim, and sometimes it feels really, really big and overpowering. But God doesn't let it get out of control. God doesn't, there is a plan. And that even if in this world we don't always feel God's plan, Latid Lavo, that's where things will play themselves out. That's where there will be justice. And again, what I find fascinating about this Rashi again is this dual approach. He has to answer, what are the Tanyim Agdolim in the simple, plain sense, context of creation? Well, explain to me, what is this creature? Dagim Gdolim Shabayam. But when it comes to the theological message, Rashi even uses the creation of the creatures in the animal kingdom to relay what? To relay important messages for mankind. So again, I think in these Rashis, just to wrap up, on the one hand, again, Rashi's concerned with the literal meaning of the text. In its context is what? A creation narrative. He's telling you what was created, how did it happen, what did it look like? And yet on multiple occasions, Rashi brings midrashim, which provide another layer of depth. Within these mysterious creations are fundamental lessons for mankind about the goals of God for his world, about how human beings should act, about reward and punishment, about evil in the world. Again, fundamental lessons for mankind. And Rashi interestingly makes the creation of the inanimate and animal world very, very much about human beings. This is a man-centric perek, according to Rashi, which is very interesting because perek bet, the other story of creation, is usually seen as the man-centric view of creation. And here Rashi makes perek aleph so much about God, really about man. God constantly teaching through his creation lessons to mankind. And again, that God is in control of nature and can and will use it for human benefit and good, if that is what we are deserving of. So again, I think the above is just a small example of the infinite depth of Torah. Rashi certainly appreciated this depth, and I think sought to help us appreciate it as well. And we can see, I think, just from our brief study here this morning, why the study of Torah is really a lifelong mission, an ongoing quest. And again, to return to our analogy from the very beginning, when it comes to Torah, yeah, we all studied the exact same text we did when we were beginners. But it seems, I think, reasonable to assume that as one advances in intellectual ability and level of comprehension, one's understanding and appreciation of the text should advance as well and not remain at the same place it was when we first encountered it. And I think that as this happens, as we allow the text to give back to us, it will touch us. I think the power of Torah is that it meets us where we are at a particular moment in time. As we grow with the text will hopefully grow with all of us. Thank you so much.